Thank you very much. I just want to remind all of the members and people at the tables that while the panel is talking, don't forget to write your questions and comments on cards and give them to your table facilitator and recorder so that we can have them ready for the panel in the second part. Great.
Carol Browner, Principal, The Albright Group.
Good morning, and let me start by thanking all of you for joining us at this session on the renewables revolution. We have a great panel for you. We're going to have a great conversation here. Before we bring our panelists on stage, though, we have a special treat. We have a special guest, the Governor of Florida, Governor Charlie Crist, and it's a real honor for me to get to introduce him since I am actually a native Floridian. And you're mostly a native Floridian. You came there when you were very tiny. But Governor Crist has been at the forefront of the whole climate change discussion that is going on in our states and has provided tremendous leadership, not just in Florida, but across the country and around the world. And so we are pleased that you were able to take some time out of your schedule today to be with us. And while we welcome you to the stage, let us also congratulate you on your upcoming December wedding. He is here with his fiancée, Carol Rome. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you very much, Carol. I told her, I said, well, from one Carol to another, that was very kind of her to make that acknowledgement, and I am truly blessed. Well, let me talk about Carol's accomplishments and what she has done not only for Florida but for America very briefly. An extraordinary Floridian and a dear friend and someone for whom I have enormous respect because of her accomplishments and maybe even more so because of her drive and her heart. So, Carol Browner, Secretary, thank you very, very much for what you have done. And please give her a round of applause. She deserves it. I just wanted to share a few thoughts because things went over a little bit downstairs. I'm tightened up, and I'll try to be efficient. I wanted to share a privilege I had recently in Florida to be able to bring a message of hope and opportunity to Wall Street, of all places, recently about some innovation that we are offering from the Sunshine State. It was a piece of legislation that offers $2 billion of investment in technology and, what concerns me the most, green technology. And I was very excited to have the opportunity to sign this legislation here in New York and have this kind of cash infusion devoted from my fellow Floridians to a better technology for our country and our world. The legislation also doubles Florida's alternative investments from $9.2 billion to $18.4 billion, not a small sum of money in anyone's estimate. And other venture firms will likely invest even more, I hope and believe, as a result of Florida's increased investment. I would invite all of you who have an interest in accessing those and accessing those almost $2 billion to visit a website, either myflorida.com or sbafla.com. That's a great opportunity to do some very good things. I also had the honor this summer of signing bipartisan legislation in Florida that created additional economic opportunity for the Sunshine State and increasing our use of renewable energies in Florida. I had a visit early on, about a month after I got sworn in as governor in 2007, from a gentleman named Terry Tamminen, who had been serving Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. And Terry came into my office, and he showed me a big map of the United States of America. And he said, you know, Governor, you're a new governor, and I wanted to show you what's happening in California, the accomplishments that we've been able to make there. There have been great things that have happened in the other northwestern states in our country and in the northeastern part of America. But when it comes to the southeast of the United States, there hasn't been a whole lot moving forward as it relates to climate change and the environmental policies that are important. He goes, you're the new governor of Florida. And he says, that means you have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to do something very good and potentially lead in this part of our country. And so we embarked upon some things, and we've had some relative success with wind, solar, other renewable energies, biomass, and I'm very, very pleased by what we've been able to do We have sought to remove the barriers to greater investments in renewables in the Sunshine State. That's why solar is so important to us. But in addition, we also have net metering requirements that relate to power. Net metering, which would give full retail rate for renewable power as an offset to the traditional sources of power. We're paving a way for expanding the production and use of renewable energy. We are encouraging innovative solutions that will expand our capacity for renewable energy, and solar energy is on the forefront of all of that, along with wind and wave and currents. In addition to ethanol, we in Florida are embarking upon a project that is historic. It is the purchase by the state of about 187,000 acres of land near Lake Okeechobee that is now used for farming sugar. And it would include sugar mills if we get it all right. And one of the things we want to do with those mills is transform them from producing sugar to producing ethanol made from sugar. It's a much more efficient way to produce it. It doesn't make food cost more because it's not born out of corn. And we think it's the future of energy independence, along with some other very good ideas that we heard about this morning here at the conference. I want to conclude by explaining how we've been able to do this. We've been very fortunate. And we have done it by bipartisan opportunities. I would really refer to them as nonpartisan. The energy bills that we have done, along with other health care bills, cover Florida, which we believe will offer affordable health care to about the 4 million Floridians who do not have it now for about $150 a month, where now it costs $600 or $700 a month. We, for the first time in the Sunshine State, now have an autism bill that will cover children who have autism in Florida for the first time in the history of our state. And both in the House and in the Senate, there was not one single no vote. Every Democrat, every Republican voted yes. Same on the energy bill. Every Democrat, every Republican voted yes. And the same on the Cover Florida Health Package. Every Democrat and every Republican voted yes. It is us working together to try to do what is right for the people who elect us and expect us to serve them. Could be a model for America. Thank you all very much, and God bless you for what you're doing.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. Wesley Clark, retired U.S. Army General and Director, Emerja Wind Technologies. Peggy Liu, Founder and Chairperson, JUICE, Joint U.S.-China Cooperation on Clean Energy. Marcel Brennickmeyer, Founder and Chairman, Good Energies. Lester Brown, President, Earth Policy Institute. Carol Browner, Principal, The All Right Group.
We have got a great set of panelists here. We've got creative thinkers, doers, investors, and what we're going to be talking about here is the renewables revolution. 30% of new energy in the United States last year came from wind. Iceland, we hear about, is almost all geothermal now. Solar entrepreneurship in China is growing more and more successful. But if you look around the world, worldwide, renewables are still only a fraction of our energy production. And so what I want to do is start very quickly, go down the row here with our experts, and ask you to each answer the same question in a one-word answer, a one-sentence answer, and then we'll open it up. The question is, what would it take in your mind for the world to really scale up on renewables? What's the one most important thing the world could do? Lester?
I think get the price right for energy, get the market to tell the environment. Get the price right, get the market to tell the environmental truth. General Clark and I were talking earlier. One of the problems is that...
You get one word. Market. We'll be back to you.
Market with tax restructuring.
Okay. Marcel.
Well, I believe that getting the right framework for people to invest will help.
So the investment opportunities, Peggy.
So I won't repeat. For China, we are investing. I think the key is the implementation of smart grid so that we can allow the renewables onto the grid.
And General Clark.
Back to what Lester was saying, it's the market. You've got to pay the full cost, the not only the economic cost, but the climatological cost, environmental costs, and social costs for carbon. Once you know what the real price that you're paying is, then renewables will come in.
Well, let me, you all have taken us into the market discussion, so let me ask you a follow-up along those lines. What role do you see a cap-and-trade program playing? We have several who are active here in the United States and also from a global perspective. Is that the market mechanism that is most likely to get us the kind of pricing we need? Lester?
If you were to take a poll of economists, they would probably 95% say, let's restructure the tax system. It's clear, it's clean, it's transparent, it's honest, and it works. Industries prefer cap and trade. I think in the end, as Mayor Newsom said this morning, we're going to have some combination of both. Mm-hmm. But the tax restructuring, lowering income taxes and offsetting it with a higher carbon tax is really a fairly simple, straightforward thing that we could phase in over the next dozen years. And once people know what's happening, then investment decisions begin to change very rapidly.
Marcel, can you talk a little bit about cap and trade, maybe from a global perspective and as a businessman?
What we see is that the real cost of energy is not attributed to energy cost. So this morning we heard that oil is very expensive. I would say it's still not expensive enough. Energy prices are going up. We have seen in European countries 15% power price increases. At the same time, and I don't want to jump ahead, but if we look at the solar costs, they have come down like they will be halved in 5 years. We have several roadmaps in several of the companies where we've invested, where we can halve the cost of a panel within 5 years. So the one is going up, the other is coming down, and there will be a crossroad, which we can discuss later on.
And so, Peggy, from your perspective, I mean, you've been an entrepreneur, you've been in the business world, now you're leading a large NGO. You know, one of the big debates every time our Congress talks about cap and trade is what's going to happen in China.
Well, in China, I'd like to sort of shift the debate from cap and trade to something more homegrown, which is our 11th five-year plan. So in 2006, the central government said we are going to reduce by 2010 10% of our emissions. We're going to decrease energy intensity per unit GDP by 20%. And so I think the key in China is not necessarily the cap and trade, although it's very interesting. For China, what works is KPIs. It's the key performance indicators that are tied to the local leaders, the mayors, that are responsible for implementing these targets locally. And we're actually moving towards that. So this last year, these last 12 months, as Juice has been growing, we have seen phenomenal progress in the central government, the Chinese central government's intentions. And so look to our KPIs to grow more specific and lead the local leaders towards helping the local cities to implement clean, renewable technologies.
General Clark, you're 38 years in the Army, 4 stars. Can you talk a little bit about the issue of energy and renewables from a defense perspective?
Well, strictly from the defense perspective, I mean, we're the largest consumer of petroleum in the country. That's probably not going to change in the near term, although, you know, we've been looking for electric drive on tanks and so forth and for a long time. The Navy's gotten away from boilers, as you know, and they're into nuclear. But I think that to really understand the national security side of this, you have to go back to the market. If you look at the market, let me just give everybody an example of what the market looks like in a small southern state that I know pretty well. In the 1990s, we thought the future of energy was natural gas. We built a lot of natural gas turbine plants. Natural gas was a dollar per million BTUs, except maybe in the heating season when it went up a little bit. We had some backup. We had the old coal-fired plants. Now it's 80% coal. We get it for $1.80 per million BTUs coming in out of Wyoming on long-term contracts. We don't use natural gas except during the max season. There's a little bit of hydropower, a little bit of nuclear. And the way it was explained to me by the people who do this, they said, we're concerned because we're selling our power now at 5 cents a kilowatt hour wholesale. It's 8 cents retail. And if you put a $10 carbon tax on it, that'll raise it a penny. So it's a $10 carbon tax, it'll be 6 cents. For a $20 carbon tax, it's 7 cents. And for a $40 carbon tax, it's 9 cents. So industry, the utilities, nobody wants this carbon tax. It changes a lot of, it moves a lot of people out of their carbon, out of their comfort zone. But I do agree with the point that Lester was making, that we're going to move, I hope, to a cap and trade and some kind of a carbon tax, because that's the best way to send to the market the signals about what the real cost of energy is and help all of us live with that cost.
Marcel, you mentioned your work in solar. Can you spend a few minutes just helping us understand sort of what are the opportunities and then what are the obstacles specifically as it relates to solar?
When I started in solar in 2001, the industry had a size of about 200 megawatts. 5 years later, it was 4 gigawatts, which is equivalent to a nuclear power plant with a gigawatt, if you take the sun hours and divide them by the yearly hours we have. And it's projected to grow like by another factor of 5 to 10 within like another 5 or 6 years. So solar, for me, was the area to enter because it was small enough to be meaningful in that area, but also because it has probably the greatest propositions of all the renewables. Now, we do need all the renewables to combat climate change, but solar is the area where I believe, or where we believe, and this is based on studies by Shell. Shell, for instance, put out a study at the end of last century where solar will take about two-thirds of the entire energy provision by 2100. Now, the way I sold it to my family was that we're a large family business. Sixth generation is now entering. I said, well, it's only 4 more generations for us to hit 2100. So do you want to be in this business, yes or no? Now, given the fundamentals of solar, that you can use it decentral, that you can use it on-grid, you can have thin film, concentrated crystalline silicon-based, you can have thermal solar, CSP. So there are many options. And the nice thing about solar is it correlates quite well with the peak of the day of the consumption. Now, it's a little bit on the early side, meaning that by the time that solar has its peak, it's just before the peak of the consumption. If you take California, where you have 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the highest consumption, solar is about 1 o'clock. But you could cover the first half of that peak. And there are other means, other storage means, ice energy, things like that, where you can do the second half. So in order to cut the peak and avoid expensive and CO2-emitting baseload, solar is probably one of the best propositions. Besides using it for third world countries, where we have projects, for instance, in Ethiopia supported, where access to energy via solar is the cheapest way of doing so.
Thank you. General, you're our wind expert on the panel. Maybe you can give us a similar overview of wind and sort of what are the opportunities today and the challenges going forward.
Well, I think if you were going to think about wind, you think about, let's say, maybe $1.5 million, maybe $2 million, $2.5 million per installed megawatt. The problem is that the wind isn't where the consumption is, so you have to get it there. To get it there, you've got to really work the transmission grid. The transmission grid in the United States is very fragmented. It needs about, according to some studies, $900 billion of investment over the next 30 years. As the electricity demand in the United States grows. And that investment has to go into the right high-voltage transmission linkages between the wind corridors and the centers of consumption. In addition to that, to get wind started now, we need a steady and consistent tax regulatory regime. This year, the production tax credit is expiring. The way it works for wind producers financially is you get 6, 7, 8 cents a kilowatt hour in a power purchase agreement. if you can sell your facility to a financial investor who can use passive income tax credits, he can take advantage of a production tax credit that adds another 3 cents of value per kilowatt hour after tax. So this is pretty substantial. This is what's fueled the explosive growth of the American wind industry over the last 4 or 5 years. But that production tax credit is expiring on the 31st of December. Today, the Congress is voting and arguing again about whether or not they'll extend it. The extension is only for another year. The cost of the extension is $5 billion for the one-year extension. So, and yet, the entire wind industry in the United States, the investors, the manufacturers, the wind park developers, 90% of that industry is hinged on this congressional vote. It's a terrible stop-go response from the country that should be the leader in renewables, and yet we can't seem to get our own policy straight.
I have to agree. It's been very disappointing that Congress has not been able to get this straight. And you know, the one thing I learned as a regulator, as the administrator of the EPA, is you got to give the business community certainty and predictability if they're going to make the investments. And I think this is a fabulous example. Lester, I want to go to you. You know, you're the co-author, I think, of 50 books or so. I think nobody in the environmental arena has probably there's not a person in the environmental arena who hasn't gone to your books on more than one occasion when we needed a fact, when we needed to understand the nuances of something. And so I have sort of two questions for you, and I know you've thought a lot about how sort of the scalability and how we manage that, but also maybe some of the other renewables that we haven't talked about, like geothermal, and maybe some thoughts on that.
The book is called Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save
Civilization. But there are 49 others.
The thing that I have found most interesting and pleasantly surprising over the last maybe year or so has been the extraordinary increase in the scale of thinking and planning in the development of renewable energy resources around the world. I mean, we all know about Texas, for example. Texas has over 5,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity, I think more than Denmark now. It has 20,000 under development as the Governor Perry's effort to build these two transmission lines from West Texas and from the Texas Panhandle. There are another 20,000 megawatts of wind in the development and planning stages, including two 600-megawatt wind farms near Corpus Christi on the coast. Developers are now looking at the coastal wind in Texas. This totals 45,000 megawatts. That, when developed, will more than satisfy the residential needs of Texas by a wide margin. Texas, which has been our leading producer of oil, is now our leading producer of wind-generated electricity and will become an exporter of wind as it has been of oil. Or look at South Dakota with Clipper Wind and BP in a joint venture developing 5,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity. That's probably three times as much as South Dakota could consume. But they're going to build a transmission line into Illinois, feed that electricity into Chicago and the Midwestern industrial heartland. Another oil man, a lot of oil money now going into wind. Phil Anschutz, who started in oil in Colorado, this 2,000-megawatt wind farm in south-central Wyoming, just on the west side of the Continental Divide, and he's has the right-of-way now, has the rights to build a 900-mile transmission line to California. That transmission line is intended to carry eventually tens of thousands of wind-generated electricity from Wyoming to California and other points in the southwest. An example outside the United States. Scotland, the government of Scotland, is negotiating with two investment funds in Dubai to invest $7 billion in an offshore transmission grid off the east coast of Scotland that will link with Europe and enable the Scots to develop 40,000 megawatts of offshore capacity. Another example, Algeria. Algeria is now planning to develop 6,800 megawatts of solar thermal generating capacity. They know that they will not much longer be exporting oil, but they want to keep exporting energy in the form of solar-generated electricity to Europe via undersea cable. That has now morphed into a proposed project of a transmission line from Morocco across the top of Africa up through Syria that would be designed to carry and connect 130,000 megawatts of solar thermal generating capacity. I mention this just to give a sense of what's happening. You asked about geothermal. Indonesia has announced it's going to develop, and this is just in recent weeks, 6,800 megawatts of geothermal generating capacity. This is a country with 500 volcanoes, 131 of which are active, enormous amount of energy near the surface. The principal agency responsible for developing geothermal in Indonesia is Pertamina, the state oil company. Oil production's falling in Indonesia. They're now a net oil importer. They see their future in geothermal energy, and Pertamina may be the first oil company, state or private, to make a major shift from oil into renewable energy resources. So the scale of thinking now in this field is just extraordinary, and we've not seen anything like it before. And I think it's partly because of a comment T. Boone Pickens made when he was asked why he, an oil man, for 60 years, now 81 years old, is investing $10 billion in wind. He said very simply, I've gotten tired of oil depletion curves. And what he's acknowledging is that when he invests in wind and the infrastructure, he's investing in an energy system that can last forever. I mean, of course, you have to replace the bearings and so forth, but this is the excitement that's now driving this huge, huge jump in the scale of thinking with renewables.
Peggy, if you could maybe help us understand sort of what are the mix of renewables that China will be looking towards and you know, how you see that playing out. You talked a little bit about the government's plan, but you know, as an entrepreneur, as someone who's been on the business side of issues, if you can maybe talk a little bit from that perspective.
So great numbers from Lester. The scale of what's happening in China is huge. So if you take a look at what we spent last year, 2007, in renewables alone, it was $10 billion. The government's plan is to get our energy mix of renewables to 15%, which I think compares to Europeans' 20%. Right, so that's very favorable given the fast amount of time that we're progressing. There is tremendous international cooperation opportunities in renewables. China is looking to the West and North and South and East to have you bring in know-how and technologies. I was just on the phone with State Grid yesterday, and they're like, we really want to invest more in wind generation. Just so you know, in China, there's only two utilities. One of them, the state grid, covers 88% of our land mass. So it's an oligopoly. It's a very simple sales cycle for any of you out there who are trying to come in to China and make money. And they are very eagerly looking to know-how for education, for how do you measure, do assessments, software technology, not just the turbines. So in wind, we are doubling. So last year, I think we had an installed capacity of 6 gigawatts. This year, I think we're moving to 13 by the end of 2008. I believe that the Chinese Renewables Association just estimated that we're going to be at least 30 gigawatts by 2015. So these are really large numbers. It's very exciting. Solar, you probably already know that one of the richest men was an entrepreneur in solar panels in China. Everybody knows that. But, you know, 90% of our panels goes outside of China. We're not deploying them inside. However, again, in the last 12 months have been really, really crucial for China. Any of you who have been to China in the last 5 years needs to come to China again and see what's happening. We're developing large wind farms, solar farms. So Baoding, which has declared itself a solar city, is creating whole supply chains of cities, an economic zone. Whole supply chains of different industries. So solar, there's a huge number, I think 30 to 50 different companies just focused on different aspects of creating solar panels. You've probably heard of Yiling Baoding. That's from Baoding. Wind, they've got, again, a few tens of companies just focused on different parts of the supply chain. And then they're also building a huge solar farm around the city. A lot of you might be familiar with Erzhao, which is sort of a sunshine city of 3 million million, a very small city in China. We've got every rooftop has solar thermal. So we are really, really trying to do the right thing for China and for the world. They are very interested in international cooperation. What JUICE does is try to translate, to convene the right players from international experts and bring them to local leaders so that they can help deploy this clean and efficient energy as fast as possible. I'll give you a really interesting example. Again, I was meeting with State Grid last week, and I was showing them some pictures of recent events that JUICE has done, including bringing David Sandilow and Ken Lieberthal over to meet with a variety of government leaders. And they looked at this picture, and they're like, is that David Sandilow? We had five translators spend weeks translating his book, Freedom from Oil, into Chinese, and we distributed it in digital format to all our leaders. Again, the State Grid is the leading utility in the world. Okay, so can you believe how much interest they have in learning from the international community? Now, they didn't just translate it. They then said, can you put us in touch with David Sandilow? We want to publish it in China. So what I've done today is, David, can you come up? Are you around? They have asked me to personally to give David. Come on up.
So what we're supposed to understand now is that David is now a rock star in China.
Like we're going to go there?
At the State Grid, yes. And they're like, would you please hand over this written top secret translation in Chinese of your book, and we would like to cooperate with David Sandilow to publish this in Chinese in China for the entire country. So I'd like to spontaneously create a new commitment with you, David, between JUICE and David Sandilow and the State Grid to teach the Chinese people about how we can have freedom from oil. And so I'd like to also give you a Beijing Olympic T-shirt, since I know you weren't able to come. So
I'm speechless. My only words are "xiexieni." So.
Thank you. Congratulations. I think it would be inappropriate to have this panel discussion today and all the optimism, which I think we all share about renewables, without spending just a moment putting it into the context of the current economic situation. And particularly Lester and General Clark, I want you to maybe spend, we don't have much time, and I want to hear from both of you, about how you think our current economic situation, how renewables are going to play into that. Should we be concerned that there's going to be a slowdown? I actually think maybe there's an opportunity here, but you know, as people who look at this on a daily basis, and General, why don't I start with you?
Well, there's still money in the financial community to invest in renewables. In fact, the hottest sector is the renewable sector. Solar is very hot. Wind will be hot if we can resolve the production tax credit issue. So there's a lot of interest in that. Also, that if you look at this financial crisis, you cannot get out of this crisis by fixing the banking system. The banking system is part of the supporting network for the American economy, but it's not the driver of the American economy. You've got to do something for the homeowners. I think everybody understands that. But the basic thing is you've got to create jobs in America. You can't just invest in homes and consume. And one of the great things America can do is produce. So our company that I'm representing up here, EWT, for example, is a Dutch company. We're bringing manufacturing facilities into the United States. And that's not out of altruistic motives. That's because it's cheaper to manufacture in the United States than it is in Europe for the kind of technology that we're using. So I think that when we move into the renewable sector, we can create lots of jobs. They're good jobs. And they're part of what we need to keep America growing. I think that's the ultimate way we move out of the financial crisis.
And you talked, let me do a follow-up. We talked about how we started with everyone agreeing that it's really sort of the market signal, the market mechanisms that are going to be important to really stimulating the kind of investment and commitments. Do you think, and I'll ask you to put on your political hat here. Do you think we're going to see a reluctance in Washington to make that kind of political commitment? We saw, you know, Governor Mayor Newsom talking about this, others talking about it earlier. Are people going to become reluctant to sort of delve into this energy world with the financial crisis?
Well, in the near term, they certainly are reluctant. There's a coalition of House Democrats called the Blue Dog Democrats, mm-hmm. and they want to go back to the 1990s principle of paying as you go so you don't keep running up the national deficit and the national debt. But I think the financial crisis and the extraordinary sense of emergency around this will give the next president, whoever he is, the opportunity to put forward some really bold programs in this area. And so you just have to take this as an opportunity. And I think it will be an opportunity if we look at it that way, that can go beyond the concerns over narrow affordability in the terms of conventional budgeting.
Lester, I'm going to give you the last. We have a minute. We have a little clock in front of us so we stay on time. And, you know, again, you know, as you looked at these issues over a very, very long time, are you concerned that the financial situation of the moment, which will be with us for some time, is going to slow sort of the political commitment to renewables and alternatives?
It probably is going to obviously affect thinking. But the thing to keep in mind is that during the last century, as the world turned to oil, we saw the globalization of the world energy economy. During this century, we're going to see the localization of the world energy economy. And that means a lot of local investment. It's difficult to imagine now the scale of jobs that's going to be created as we develop hundreds of thousands of megawatts of wind generating capacity, as we build 94 geothermal power plants, projects now underway in the western states, for example. If we look at solar thermal power and some of the huge plants now underway. Governor Crist is planning one for Florida, for example. There are some big ones in the Southwest now coming that will dwarf anything we've seen before. And then solar cells, of course, which is a very local thing, creates a lot of local employment in every community in the country. So we're looking at the job creation potential here in this industry probably exceeding anything since the IT revolution itself and the enormous expansion that came with that during the 1990s.
Great. What we're going to do now, someone's going to explain what we're going to do now, which is Carolyn. We're going to take a break, and you're going to...
Great. How about a round of applause for a fantastic panel? Because we've run late this morning in the plenary, we're only going to have a 20-minute table discussion in this topic. So we want to get you all right into it initially, get as many ideas as you can to your into your table. This is a perfect panel to follow with a question that is the core of CGI. Imagine a dream CGI commitment that could help scale up renewable energy dramatically. Imagine a dream CGI commitment that could help scale up renewable energy dramatically. Try to be as specific as you can about what would it look like and who would be involved. Our goal is to get as many good ideas, you don't have to be able to do it yourself even, but to get it out there stated so that someone could grab onto it. Have fun.